Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. Back for a second podcast of the week, and this one looking at another classic game and one of the best club matches ever. The 2001 Heineken Cup final between Leicester Tigers and Stade Francais at the... not Stade de France.
Parc des Princes.
Parc des Princes. That's quite right. The voice you just heard there was Phil, as ever. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Tim.
And the person you can hear moving around their tablet or whatever it is JB in some Egg Chaser stash, are you?
No, I'm not. Digitalk H stash.
Digitalk H,
finest club in Manchester.
So with today's game, thank you for watching. If you haven't watched, you can just hit pause right now, go to YouTube, type in Leicester versus Stade Francais 2001, watch an amazing game of rugby, and then come back and hear us talk about it. Or do it in whatever order you like. But thank you very much for listening. Let's start, though, by setting the scene, because we're going back 19 years now. Phil, what set the scene for this game and what it meant at the time and where the clubs were?
So... in the context, at this point in time, it was the biggest English club at the time, unquestionably. Leicester had won back-to-back-to-back
premierships. I'm going to have to stop you, Phil. JB, every time you move that, it makes a big noise. So you're just going to have to get it settled in one spot.
No worries.
Sorry to stop you. Just get yourself in one reclined chaise longue position.
Get comfortable.
Stay there.
No.
Oh, good lad. There he is.
Beautiful. I know that pose. So, yeah, Leicester were... this was part of four consecutive premiership titles. Or this was in the middle of four consecutive premiership titles. They'd won three up to that point, three consecutively. They obviously were competing the Heineken Cup final for the second time. They lost it, I think, 4 years previously to Brive. So they were unquestionably the biggest team in England at that time. Stade Francais were up there. It was either them or Toulouse who were the biggest team in France. Stade Francais had won two of the last three titles before 2001 and went on to win the following two titles after 2001. So that gives you some background into just how well these teams were performing at that time and how big a game it was at that time. Additionally, just to add as well, both teams contributed a huge number of players to the international setup over an extended period of time. I mean, the Leicester team, the Leicester pack, including the five subs on the bench, were all English players, England players. And most of them were England internationals as well.
It's pretty phenomenal lineups, actually. But one thing as well, it's quite rare to happen that a team will effectively have a home final, because Stade Francais play their games, or played their games back then, at the, like, literally, much like Murrayfield has the, and the Arms Park, as it was, had the pitch back in onto it. That's exactly what the Parc des Princes had, with Stade Francais playing right there.
And I think I'm always confused, right? So Stade Francais used to play, or maybe still do play, in Saint-Denis. Now, is Saint-Denis not where Stade de France is? Not Parc des Princes.
I don't know.
I haven't got a clue, mate.
I've never been to either of them.
I have been to Stade de France, and it is god awful. It is potentially one of the worst places that I have been to. So it's not the worst.
So Stade de France, you've got the running track round the pitch, haven't you? Or am I thinking of?
I didn't remember. I watched.
No, that was Racing before they moved to their new Thunderdome. Okay.
Yeah, so I remember watching. I went to watch a club game. I watched Clermont versus Stade, when Stade's number one player was Paul Williams, the fullback.
Okay. Yeah.
So not good times.
he must have crossed over with Parisi.
So he was playing at the same time as Parisi. Also playing, I'm going to say, was Digby Ioane.
Digby Ioane.
yeah, him. I'm trying to think who else. Maybe even the front. It wasn't a garbage team, but it wasn't a great team.
Yeah, well, they had this period here where it was them and Toulouse seemed to be the two best teams in France. And then quite a long period of poor performances, shall we say. Extended period of poor performances.
When the money ran out. This team.
Sorry?
When the money ran out.
Yes. And before the money came back.
So Richard, as I understand it, Richard Paul Jones, I never said this before, I'll say it again, was the last player to play for England when he was a semi-pro.
Ah, okay. So he played.
I'm not sure he was
95 or something like that.
No, it was after that, and I think the reason it happened was because he was part-time of France, Stade Francais, not because he wasn't good enough, but because he owned a publishing and printing business.
I'm going to make one little observation for future podcasts. JB, your TMO shipping container is right next door to thousands of pounds of audio equipment. And you're sat talking to us through a tablet.
Yeah, sorry about that. I just wanted to keep it real.
What was I going to say? I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. Never mind. Doesn't matter. Obviously not important.
So this was a time when I was absolutely obsessed by not only English rugby, the Premiership, which I loved, but also I sort of had half an eye on the Welsh competition too, because the Welsh competition at that time, when I first got into it, seemed quite sexy. And one of the teams that looked really, really good were Swansea, who had people like Gibbs, I'm trying to think of the name of the other centre. They had a big ginger centre. The reason that I know about this centre is because a guy in my school called Owen, who was a year younger than me, his dad was a criminal solicitor and had represented him in a case. But I can't remember what the hell his name was. Mark Taylor. There was basically a load of good guys playing for Swansea at the time. Leicester Tigers crushed them 41-10.
In the quarterfinals.
Yes.
That was. Because Swansea qualified second in their group in that year. The qualifying teams from that, so Gloucester, Cardiff, Stade Francais, Pau, Leicester, Swansea, Munster and Biarritz. So a few of the, two Welsh teams qualifying, no Leinster, not even close, and Biarritz, who used to be a powerhouse of Heineken Cup rugby.
Well, one of my observations about this game, and tying it into something we talked about on the previous podcast with Bernard Laporte's ideas for a global club game, is once again, we've watched another Heineken Cup match where the atmosphere was absolutely incredible. And this is exactly the reason why this competition has to stay.
Yes,
exactly right.
The atmosphere was incredible. And it was probably even more incredible because it was in Paris, because the Parisians don't travel all that well outside of Paris. A lot of the other French teams do, but not the Parisians. But it was a brilliant atmosphere, particularly when Stimpson was kicking for sticks and he was getting booed and hissed.
Just as he should be.
As you want in a French environment. If that's in Scotland or in England, you don't want it. If it's in France or Argentina, crack on, lads.
Yes. Yeah,
when was the last time, by the way, three Canadians played a European Cup final?
That's a great question. I couldn't think of another Canadian who'd played in a Heineken Cup final.
Presumably Cuddmore.
Cuddmore.
Other than Cuddles. played in a final and lost. But I meant to say what has won a Heineken Cup.
One won and two lost.
Yeah, Winston Stanley for Leicester and Morgan Williams and Mike James for Stad.
So yeah. Presumably that means a minus one. It's worse than not winning.
Well, yeah, and add additional ones for Cuddles.
Yeah.
He's probably lost a couple as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, minus three Canadians have won the European Cup.
Was there any playing at Wasps when they won it? I know Wasps have had a few Canadians.
Have they? Who are you thinking of? I can't think of any of them.
It's probably a bit earlier. The big one.
The prop. No.
Rod Snow.
No, Rod Snow was Newport.
It was Newport.
Norm Hadley.
Oh, yeah.
The massive Stormy Norman, who was second row, but he's way before Wasps won the...
Gareth Rees was at Cardiff. Was he?
Over him.
Canadian fly half.
Gareth Rees also played for Wasps.
For Wasps, so there you go.
Yeah, Wasps and Quins. But again, earlier than... Because this, it probably shows the trajectory of Canadian rugby. That at that point in time, 2001, so in the 90s, they were a potential powerhouse. They had a lot of good players. Early 2000s, probably a similar boat, albeit declining. And now, hardly any playing top tier rugby outside of Major League Rugby.
I mean, you can sort of understand it though, can't you? If Canadian rugby has been treading water, which it largely has actually, what was required to play for Leicester Tigers and Stade Francais just wouldn't cut it now. You can't just show up to a professional rugby club being a little bit talented or a little bit big. You've got to be playing this game for a long, long time.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just be the big lad.
No.
You've got to be bloody good.
That you saying you can't just be the big lad reminds me of one of the things from this. So Bill McLaren was one of the commentators. And and it's a reminder to me that great commentators... You don't need to bring the stats. Sometimes just say it as you see it. It doesn't need to be clever. It doesn't need to be fluffy. It doesn't need to be full of stats. And Bill McLaren was amazing because he would say things like, Tim Stimpson, oh, he's a big, strong fella. Sometimes that's all you need.
And Diego Dominguez, as he kept saying.
Yes,
Dominguez.
Dominguez. He constantly referred to him as the little lad or the little man.
Well, him and also stature. The French centre.
Yeah, Comba, the 13. Comba. Both of them he kept on saying.
Well, I mean, by the end of the game, they actually had a complex. Disappeared.
So, you know, in the classic Jonah Lomu rugby game, Bill McLaren has that, oh, he's borrowing like a demented mole breakdown.
Like a demented mole.
Well, yeah, digging like a demented mole. Well, he used the phrase, and I don't know if this is pre-Jonah Lomu rugby or post-Jonah Lomu rugby, but he said he described one of the players as being like a demented setsy fly.
Yeah, I don't know what a setsy fly is.
What is a setsy fly?
I'm assuming it's an African fly of some kind.
Yeah.
Might be the precursor to your description of Marlon Yard, JB, as a running like a house fly.
The agility of a house fly. Back in the day, not anymore.
I did notice that, and I rewound it to be like, what has he actually said?
Okay, a setsy fly is, it's a fly. And where's it from? Yeah, it's found in Africa, Central Africa.
There you go.
The obvious analogy, which the casual fan would definitely pick up on.
And this game was 4 years after Jonah Lomu Rugby was released.
So what struck me about the commentary was how accurate Jonah Lomu Rugby was. It felt like I'd seen the game before.
We didn't have Bill Beaumont in this game with very, very wooden co-coms
reading off a sheet of paper. We did.
Now, fair to say, at some point in history, Jonathan Davis has come across Morgan Stanley. Sorry, not Morgan Stanley. That's a credit card.
Morgan Williams,
and he inexplicably hates him.
He really had a beat his body.
He really hates him. Now, this guy can't be bad. I mean, Stade Francais are winning pretty much everything in sight. You know, he's obviously not a bad scrum half, but according to Jonathan Davis, he's probably the worst scrum half on the planet.
Worst scrum half to ever have played the game.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because Morgan Williams didn't have a great start to the game, and then it almost felt like, oh, Jonathan Davis's mind's made up.
Yeah, he's
useless. Whatever he does now, that I'm picking at it.
After that first 5 or 10 minutes, where a couple of his passes were slow and misaligned, he had a great game. He was covering everywhere.
Well, the best ones for that, commentary-wise, are Eddie and Steve-O from Super League, who seemed to decide how a player was going to play before the game and then carry on that narrative regardless who played well. I remember them saying about Stuart Fielding after his world record transfer to Wigan, £500,000. He's got the fire in the belly tonight. Stuart Fielding, he was awful. And he remained awful for 2 years after that.
But they've made their mind up.
I mean, that is the greatest commentary duo of all time, Eddie and Steven. There's no real debate about it.
Jonathan Davis, what was totally remarkable is he has not changed. So the overall production of rugby these days is way beyond anything we saw in the early 2000s. It's a totally different ball game, except Jonathan Davis. He was identical then as he is this year. I absolutely identical. You could snip bits of commentary and play them now and you would not be able to tell the difference. It's genuinely remarkable. Timeless.
Particularly considering that he's commentating on Austin Healey.
Yes. Yeah. Who is a very, very good commentator now.
Yes, quite. Now,
You had a big chunk of BT's broadcasting team on the field.
Yes.
Well, actually.
Ben Kay and Austin.
Yeah.
And Andy Goode, contributor.
Goody does a little bit.
Sorry, Andrew Goode, as Bill
Andrew
McLaren.
Young Andrew Goode.
Did you notice who was doing the pitch side comms on that video?
No.
Who?
Nick Mullins.
I did notice that.
Yeah, yes. Twice in the game. They went to Nick Mullins.
You telling me that Tim could become the next Nick Mullins if he just keeps his nose clean?
I'm telling you.
Wow.
Watch this face.
Wow.
They went to him twice. His first one was talking about how the game's moved on from Leicester's previous visit to the Heineken Cup final about 4 years earlier, because this time Dean Richards has got an earpiece and is in constant communication with Phil Larder and Rory Underwood.
Yeah, by the way, I didn't realise Rory Underwood was a coach.
I didn't at all.
So I had no idea he had any coaching pedigree.
He was backs and attack with Phil Larder as defence coach.
So, I mean,
I had no idea about that as Rory Underwood. I thought he was just a player legend that would do a bit. He might have been on the board at one point or something, but he was
an RAF.
Yeah, he might be, but just an RAF pilot, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Was that his brother?
No. Rory Underwood was the RAF pilot.
Yeah, okay. So, I think him and Ben Kay are actually still on the rugby committee of Leicester.
Yeah. More than I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think Simon Kelly, maybe Jeff Glynn, they've got the four ways that they used to do in the coalition government. It's that kind of thing.
just before we get into too much of the action, what did you make of the kits?
I really like the white socks of Stad. I thought the white socks of Stad really set off the red and the blue.
The kit I want, I like France wearing tricolour kit. So they have one, I don't care which order it is in, but white, blue and red, three separate colours for short socks and shirt looks awesome.
Weirdly, I do not look at that Stad kit and think France.
No, I don't.
Even though it is the right colours, it is very unique to Stad. And I don't know how they pulled it off, but it's a unique look, which has not been replicated.
The lightning bolts. Yeah. Haven't you got that shirt in the dungeon?
Sadly not. I've been hunting for the blue Stad, the electric blue Stad shirt, for as long as I can remember.
You've got a similar one, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got a pink one with blue lightning bolts.
Okay. Is that the one that Haskell, about the time that Haskell was there?
Yes. So I strongly think they should go back to the blue and red.
I love that kit.
It's such a nice kit.
And it is so, the colour palette is so unique that no one's even close to that.
And I think it's because it's like a shiny, glossy, it's like a satin almost.
Yeah. And Leicester.
Oh, Leicester's was classic.
Absolute classic kit. And I love that it is, it's 2 years before England won the World Cup. And so it is, it's an old school kit. You could have taken, apart from, if you dropped maybe two or three of the sponsors from it, because there were sponsors everywhere. If you dropped two or three of the sponsors, it could have been an identical kit, identical material to a kit in the 1950s or 1960s.
Mm. Yeah. I'm going to go one further. I'm going to say that Stad kit is probably my favourite kit of all time.
Wow.
Favourite club kit of all time.
I loved it. I thought it was awesome.
I loved it as well. One thing I did notice with some of the Stad players and a couple of the Leicester players as well, that I'm wondering when this, when we crossed the point where this didn't happen anymore, but because there was so much shoeing going on still, guys wearing shin pads.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I remember when I was younger, front rows would wear shin pads. Hookers always wore shin pads.
Yeah.
But I don't know when that stopped. But it was still going on in 2001.
I always assume that we wore shin pads just because we've got to take them out of our football bags. I mean, that's honestly what I thought.
I think it might be to do with, I remember hookers used to wear it because like the other hooker would strike.
Yeah, striking.
Because it was actually, you'd actually compete with a strike at the scrum. It wasn't fed in to the scrum arse.
Oh,
to the second row's feet.
Someone was telling me the other day, I remember who told me now, and I'm not going to embarrass him by putting his name out there, but there is a Brian Moore instructional video of how to hook a ball, which apparently is hilarious. And it's Brian Moore telling you how to hook a ball from a decade ago, after he'd already been retired a couple of decades, probably, leaning on his garden chair, and he just basically backheels the ball.
Right, that's next week's review.
The game.
Mm.
So it's not a great game.
it's an interesting game.
I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the last 10 minutes. I did enjoy it.
I enjoyed it, but it was, I enjoyed things that I... So if that was a game today, I don't think I'd enjoy it particularly. But because I was watching it with the lens that this is 19 years ago, I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed it for, like, weird things. How passionate both teams were and how fired up both packs were was incredible.
But were they that fired up? I mean, one thing that struck me is you didn't see anyone go into contact for maybe 2 minutes.
What at the start of the game?
Yeah.
Or
it was five. I think it was like the opening series of plays had like seven kicks.
There was a lot of kicking. There's a lot of kicking out of hand. Not particularly good kicking out of hand.
Yeah. It's strange that you kind of pick up on that, because it's weird how, like, just what I'm, the feeling I'm left with, because all I remember was just frenetic running play and offloading all over the shop from both teams.
Well, is that what you thought of before you watched it or after?
No, like after. When I come away with it, yes, I was aware of a bit of kicking, but I just remember watching it thinking, God, their lungs must have been absolutely busting.
That's fascinating. So the way I describe what I saw is these teams were aware of tactics, but they weren't tactically aware. So everything was kicked. I mean, they win the ball back on the halfway line. Beautiful counter-attacking ball for Stad. They kicked it. The opening salvo was seven kicks. Everything was getting kicked. Even the try for Leon Lloyd, his first try,
was a kick.
And he tries to kick it again. Austin Healey breaks the line. It looks fabulous, but by the way, and then he kicks it away. Like everything was kicked.
That was awful. That Austin break. In early on, it was a superb break. It was an absolutely brilliant break, and he's just got Dominici to either go round or draw to do something with, and he just grubbers it straight into his arms.
Yeah, so the commentary team said there's a lot of kicking because of the organised nature of these defences. I thought, yeah, okay, that's fair. But at what point do you kick enough that they've dropped their men and then you have to have a go at the organised defences? And they never seem to answer that question. So the kicking, I thought the kicking itself was fairly high quality-ish. I thought the organisation to return the kicks was not up to standard. But more importantly, the communication between the kicker and the chasers was basically non-existent. Like, they had some of it there, So they were aware that they wanted to play a tactical game. They just weren't aware of the tactics.
Well, the tactical game. So Leicester won this. Leicester had an incredibly experienced pack on the field and incredibly experienced leaders on the field. And I'd actually say that Leicester won this in spite of those players, not because of them. So Stade Francais had a very, very simple tactic, which was get into the Leicester half and take a shot at goal. Dominguez had three or four drop goals, but he scored one drop goal, but he scored nine penalty kicks.
He missed one.
He missed one. He missed two or three drop goal attempts. But Stade Francais' tactic was just get into the Leicester half and have a shot at goal by any means possible. And Leicester continually gave him those opportunities.
Now, that's so interesting, right?
They were so lazy around the ruck and on the offside line repeatedly and just kept getting pinged for the same stuff.
So it's so interesting you mention that, because all of my knowledge from this time, even though I watched all the rugby possible, and I really do mean all the rugby possible, most of my knowledge from this period of time comes from Sky Sports, the rugby club.
Yeah.
And one of the things which is mentioned in analysis of Leicester Tigers is how street smart they are. Now, then they called it street smart. Today we'd call it plain stupid. But they'd give an example of Leicester Tigers giving away a penalty. And the reason they gave away the penalties is to give away the 3 points, not the 7 points. So there's an awful lot of deliberate cheating from the Tigers. Now, nowadays, that would be an almost certain yellow card. I mean, deliberate cheating is just a yellow card. I can see that this Leicester Tigers team, if the rules were as they are now, basically not being on the field.
Leicester gave away a huge number of stupid penalties. Probably none more stupid than the one that Martin Johnson gave away that got himself yellow carded and gave Diego Dominguez another 3 points, which was just he was slightly being held back from a scrum.
Very slightly.
Very, very slightly. And he landed a couple of punches on one of the Stade forwards, 2 meters away from the referee. Like, he's not hidden by anyone. There is no one obstructing the referee's view, and he just lands two punches on the guy, gets himself yellow carded. And it's not like he didn't know that he was going to get yellow carded, because one of Stad's most experienced player, the hooker, Landreau, did a very, very similar thing early on in the game and got himself yellow carded.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I watched this episode. Now, I admit that I was watching it during my 1 hour constitutional whilst walking, but I was watching it. And I can only assume he got yellow carded for assisting a lift for the restart.
That was the way that it was described in comms. But if you watch that replay, right at the end of it, he does throw a couple of punches.
Ah, that makes so much more sense. Like,
the ref signals as well. The ref does signal a punch.
I just thought that was incredibly harsh for assisting a lift.
Not in those days. In those days, it would have been incredibly harsh.
I can sleep easy now.
He also did throw a few punches.
Unpopular opinion, maybe, is I quite liked seeing a punch being punished with a yellow card. And perhaps when it's a really bad punch, or, you know, then you reserve the red card for something really dirty and nasty. But if it's a punch that has kind of little material effect or impact, I'm quite happy with the yellow card. I quite like that. But
all right,
you're not allowed to say that these days.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing which you're definitely not allowed to say. I don't think Martin Johnson was very good.
Oh, JB, how dare you?
He wasn't. I'm not saying he wasn't good in his career. That'd be ridiculous.
I was going to say, you're talking generally, yeah, not about this game.
Yeah. back to Sky Sports Rugby Club. I remember they did a montage about Martin Johnson, and it was literally a montage of him standing near rucks swearing at referees.
Well, it's funny you should mention this, because, I mean, Martin Johnson is well, one of the greatest captains ever, Lions captain, England World Cup winning captain, captain Leicester to quadruple back-to-back-to-back league titles, back-to-back Heineken Cup titles. I mean, in this game, the only time I noticed him was him doing that monumentally stupid punch and getting yellow-carded, and then fuming on the touchline for 10 minutes. They kept on cutting to him on the touchline.
Let's be very honest with ourselves now. Between the three of us and in front of the rest of the world, what is the defining Martin Johnson performance on a rugby field and why?
World Cup final.
Yeah, but why? What did he do?
Because he captained. Because sometimes, sometimes the leadership skills are more important than the out and out performance of a player.
So objectively,
well, no. I'm going to jump in. Yeah, I would say the World Cup performance is his defining moment. But as a player, he is a classic in the common parlance: tight head lock. He just hits rucks. He takes care of his. He does all his work with no flash and no glamour so that other people can. But in that World Cup final, the crucial drop goal was set up partly because Matt Dawson identified that there was a little gap, did the dummy and goes to make an extra 20 metres. But then Martin Johnson is the next man up, following up with a carry that got another 5-10 metres further forward. It's a brilliant carry just before the ball gets passed back to Wilkinson.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Martin Johnson probably occupied a role in rugby which you probably couldn't have now, and that is someone who doesn't want the ball. Because objectively, if you were to look at the two of them and say who would make it in today's modern game, it would be Ben Kay times a million because of what he can do carrying the ball. He was a lot more action.
I think I disagree. Yeah, I think I disagree. I think they're never held up as superstars. They are never the ones that have loads of people talking and writing about them. But people in teams understand how important guys like Martin Johnson are.
I don't doubt he was massively important for those teams that he played at that time. I can't think of a player in the modern game who was like Martin Johnson.
Well, perhaps England could have done with a tight headlock in the World Cup final.
Maybe Martin Johnson. What was he, 6'4"?
6'7".
Wow. Okay, a lot bigger than I thought.
Ed Slater at Gloucester is one in the Premiership.
Ed Slater's a really good example, actually. That is a pretty good example.
Yeah. I do understand what you mean. They were more in vogue back in the day. Like, remember when Quinns had Ollie Cohn? Just a 22 stone lock.
Wrecking machine. Lump. Yeah, well, I don't think he covered himself in glory, particularly this game is where I'd end up.
No, yeah. And I would agree with that. And partly because he didn't do that much around the field. Although, to be fair, when you're on the wide shot, you can't see who's hitting rooks based on the resolution of the video that we saw. Yeah. So he might have hit 200 rooks in that game for all I know.
Yeah, and when analysis is done, they get involvements is one of the ways that players' performances are analysed and stripped back and measured. And I wouldn't mind betting that Martin Johnson is one of those guys that has more involvements than anyone else, but more involvements that don't get put on highlight reels than anybody else, but yeah. Really vital contributions.
Yeah, I'm going to drop a name here. Are you ready?
Go on.
So when I used to do another podcast from the dungeon, which I didn't speak on, but did happen in my house, I was chatting to John Wilkin, and John Wilkin, rugby league legend. In case you don't know, rugby league legend, and also very rude. So yes, two things can be true at once. He was explaining that he didn't understand in rugby, and this kind of goes back to my Martin Johnson point, how you can have players who don't want to touch the ball. And he explained, I can't remember who he was talking about. I guess it must have been one of the Seattle Sharks boys because they're so close. But he was explaining that he couldn't understand how these players would basically say, don't give me the ball. Don't give me the ball. I don't want to see the ball one bit.
Because they want to be doing the hard work.
Yeah.
Richard Hill is probably a good example of that kind of guy.
Exactly.
Who's so important. And he was always described as You'll never notice him, but every team that he plays in will be better because he's in that team.
Mm.
On the rugby league thing, everything comes back to Sam Burgess.
Of course.
I remember when, like, one of the critiques from, I can't remember who it was, but a rugby league player or former player, when he came across to Union, was one of the huge advantages of Sam Burgess was the fact that he was 6'4", 6'5", 18 and a half stone, but had an unbelievable engine on him, and so could have carry after carry after carry and tackle after tackle and make 30 carries and 30 tackles, like 60 involvements a game. And if he's playing rugby union, whether it's centre or back row or wherever you end up sticking him, he might have half a dozen carries and half a dozen tackles a game. So his biggest asset in rugby league, which is the combination of his fitness and size, well, you only get the size part of it. You don't get the fitness side.
Yeah, the captivity of Sam Burgess in rugby union is equally as cruel as anything that you'll see on Tiger King.
Back to the game. So,
yes,
who stood out in terms of the best players on the field for you guys?
There's two really good ones, but one guy head and shoulders above everyone else on the field.
You might say the same person as me.
Okay, Tim, have you got one guy in particular?
I've got one guy in my mind. Yeah,
best player on the park.
I'm gonna say Pat.
Sorry, go on.
Pat Howard.
So Pat Howard would probably be the second best for me.
What? There's someone better than Pat Howard on the field?
I thought Austin Healey was the best man on the field.
Austin Healey was... So.
That's what I was going to say.
I thought Austin Healey was very good.
But this is why I think Pat Howard was better. Because when you watch his old games, you often see things... Well, no, you don't see anything, really. You see guys who are, you know, a bit quicker than the average bloke or a bit more skillful or whatnot. I actually watch Pat Howard do things I don't even see in the modern game.
He was ahead of the curve in that game. Some of his offloads out the back and the timing of his passes and like his cross-field kick that we mentioned before for the Leon Lloyd first try. Stuff like that was superb.
His hands close to the line. He made one of the most simple moves in rugby look like something I've never seen before, which is he gets the ball, he is hitting a hard line, and then before he hits a hard line, without breaking the step, he just passes the ball to Leon Lloyd. And for all the world, I'm thinking that he's going to crash the ball in. He's just such a skillful player. There's a little behind-the-back flick. You know, I thought he was one of the few players in that team who would make it today in a modern rugby team.
I think another one was someone else who was ahead of the curve in the way that the game is now versus the way it was then. Neil Back, I thought was his turnovers were you didn't see any jackaling going on with any other player, and he was doing stuff that came in several years later.
Yeah, so he was superb on that. Just on Neil Back as well. So. The turnover that won the game, actually, the final turnover was him, and no one else would have got that. But also the second Leon Lloyd. Oh no, it was his try. It was the Neil Back try. He started that with a midfield mispass to Leon Lloyd because it was turnover ball. He identified it and executed a midfield mispass that I bet none of the other Leicester forwards could have executed that. I'd actually go as far to say as probably none of the four other forwards on that pitch could have executed what he did at that time.
So I don't quite agree with you. And this is one of the things that I was going to bring up, which is this was rugby pre-George Smith. So the Lions tour to Australia is in what? It's the next year, right?
It's this year. It's
this is the last club game before it.
Yeah,
right. This has been the year George Smith comes on. Can you believe that, by the way? So this is George Smith is playing professional rugby at this time, and I think he might still be playing now somewhere.
He was. I think he might have now retired just last season. He was at Bristol last year.
He went somewhere else. I'm sure he went somewhere else.
Let's have a quick look.
Anyway, your point being,
point is. He really did change the game because nobody jackled. So what I thought of watching Neil Back is he did he was the closest thing to Smith before Smith, but he wasn't quite there. Like, it wasn't quite the same thing. I always remember people in school, well, I say school, like when I was growing up, the coaches I had, bearing in mind, I had garbage coaches, so I shouldn't really listen to any of them. But they always said, like, oh, a good flanker is always on the ball first, you're always trailing the ball, you're always getting those turnovers, but you're getting it by sheer hard work. They weren't quite at the level that Smith kind of invented, and then McCaw took to the next level. That didn't really come in, I don't think, until about a year or so later.
Well, the number seven that was the blueprint for, like, modern rugby was Michael Jones for New Zealand in the late 80s, early 90s. He was just had the most incredible engine, was a perfect link player who would arrive at right place, right time. But I think Neil Back was a brilliant link player, but added this ability to do work on the floor and turn defence into attack.
Yeah, he had the floor work, but it was kind of like every loose ball was Neil Back's.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he had an incredible engine as well.
He did have, yeah, he did.
Back here.
Do you think he ever got over, what's that? Do you think he ever got over his incident in Leeds?
I'm sure he survived. I'm sure he eventually got over it.
I hear that he still holds a massive grudge.
Because I promised him I'd find at the Oktoberfest Leeds beer thing. I was a bit drunk and he was queuing to get in, and I promised him that I'd find a bouncer who knew rugby. This was in about 2010. He knew something about rugby, who would get him in, and went inside and promptly forgot about it, and he had to stay queuing.
Poor Neil Back.
Whoops.
Never recovered.
No. It was quite a turnaround as well in the last 10 or 20 minutes for Leicester, wasn't it? Because they were 21-10 down?
Yeah, so annoyingly, there was no score on the TV and there was no clock. So I thought it was a lot more even. In fact, I thought Leicester went quite far ahead because they were 2-0. In the end, they were 3-0. Turns out I was completely wrong.
Yeah, their second try, I think, only brought them level at about either 21-all or 24-all, just because they'd been so careless with the sheer number of stupid penalties that they repeatedly gave away and just didn't learn from.
I wonder if it says something about the standards of kicking back in the day, which was you might be able to get away with that if you were doing it, I don't know, mind you, they weren't bad kickers back in the day. I mean, I'm just thinking who they'd be playing against, like Mercier at Gloucester or Grayson or Wilkinson at Newcastle or Grayson at Northampton. I mean, they didn't have bad kickers, but maybe they could get away with giving away all those penalties. And then, how do you say his name? Dominguez? No, how does McLaren say his name?
Dominguez.
Dominguez just puts on a masterclass.
His kick, Dominguez's kicking was something else. He missed one off the tee, which was actually one of the easier ones, early in the second half, that he just went to give it a little dink and just slightly mistimed it, miscued it and pulled it.
Well, do you know the other thing which stood out to me, and this sounds crazy now, I think this Leicester team in a lot of ways is underrated, so bear with me. The back division in particular. Outside of Austin Healey, who was in and out of the England squad, there's no real established internationals there. Even Jordan Murphy took a hell of a time to get into the Ireland squad. Then you've got... you don't really count Canada as a tier one nation.
Well, but Leon Lloyd, Pat Howard was an international player of repute. But well, yeah,
Pat Howard left Australia because he wasn't getting... because he wasn't getting a game.
Yeah.
So, and then you've got Goody, Leon Lloyd, and Stimpson. They all played international, but they were never regulars.
Yeah, well, Stimpson was more down to injury, wasn't it?
I don't know, because I remember him playing a lot, an awful lot. So he might have been. Have I misremembered this? Was he the one that didn't quite finish the try away in South Africa?
for either the Lions or England? I'm guessing it's England.
He went on the 97 Lions tour, but I think
I'm sure something gets kicked. I think it's a Lions. I'm sure it's a Lions. Something gets kicked through. No, it's England. I'm sure it's England though. And he needs to score it for a historic Test victory, and he can't quite get it down.
I don't remember, but I'm not doubting you for a second.
You shouldn't doubt me ever.
Even when you say the Beast has won two World Cups.
I'm certain he has. Certainly.
One of my takeaways from this game was there was a lot of high risk rugby. Like you say, there was not many percentages played. The kicking was a little bit aimless. I think that was more down to the time than poor execution per se. That was just how it was. You have to compare apples with apples, and so you have to give some allowances for the time period we were watching. But the risk that I quite enjoyed in this game was the forwards offloading, and when it works, it is devastating. And I think that's something that we don't see enough of. There's too much emphasis on collision, and not enough emphasis on creating space for other people with an offload. I understand it's high risk, but it is high reward. And both sets of forwards, albeit, like you say, there were some clumsy things going on, there were some stupid penalties given away, they were trying to let the boys play.
They were to a certain degree. And again, I wonder if this is a product more of inept attacking rugby or nothing else. So now they're very structured, aren't they, in how they spread the field, the various formations that they run. But back then it struck me as they were just, quote-unquote, resourcing the ruck to the nth degree. Like, every forward was there. So I wonder if it's a product of just saying, well, guys, look, we're all here. Shall we just have a little, a little scramble forward, then see if we can offload? And it worked really. I tell you who played very well doing this. Dorian West. Dorian West could shift.
Yeah, he carried well a few times. And there were the Leicester team did seem like the point that you're making, Tim, when there was a turnover, they would look to quickly move the ball. So look to offload immediately. So turnover, pick it up, play it back, and then spread it wide, which is definitely I'd think of it as a more modern tactic. You think of teams like Scarlets or Connacht doing that better.
Yeah, I think the big difference is there wasn't really the space to do it. Or if there was, it's like lax defence. So imagine having all your forwards honeypotting like they were then now. You just go nowhere fast. I mean, it'd be killed me.
Oh, no. Of course, I'm absolutely right. I'm just kind of making the point that if... I don't know if it's that defences are so exactly what you're saying, that they fan out so much that it's harder to break down, or whether it's a kind of number crunch percentages thing, but... I think what was in these games that we're watching that is lacking a bit now is that kind of ambition from forwards, really, to not just try and bust a hole with a physical collision. But I think that's probably a consequence of the way that the defences are set up.
Do you not think the big thing that is missing is the lack of a multi-phase plan? So it's very much like, let's go, let's run a move, then the pack show up and they do a little bit of juggling. And then they move it wide, and then they sort of run out of ideas and kick it.
Yeah, you probably described more phases than there ever were actually in that game before kicking it, because it was three phases and then kick it. Actually, the only time when it went more phases than that, pretty much from both teams, was right at the end when Stimpson's conversion from the touchline was actually the most important kick of the game. Because it meant that Stade Francais had to score a try rather than just get a penalty.
Yeah. Stimpson's kicking throughout his career was awesome. It haunts me because I remember him sticking one over at the... Do you remember when he kicked one at the Forest Ground? Is it Forest Ground? Well, what's not the Forest Ground called?
County Ground.
County Grounds. Sorry. And I think it must have gone off all three posts. It definitely went off two posts. To win the game against Scarlets.
I can't remember. Was that a few years later?
Yeah, it might have been on the way to... It might be the year after, actually.
Well, Stimpson, he won five consecutive premierships because he won the year bef-
he won the year before Leicester's four Premiership run with Newcastle in 97.
You're right.
I want to say.
And then he went back to Newcastle afterwards.
He was at Leeds for a bit as well.
Was he?
Yeah.
Wow. Very muscular jaw.
He was a big, strong boy. As
Bill McLaren said. Big strong fella. Big, yeah, strong big, fella.
How big was he?
6'4".
Yeah, 6'3", 6'4".
No, he wasn't.
Yeah, he was. He was a big unit.
So I thought, is he big? So
he's listed as 6'3 and 105 kg.
Yeah.
Which bloody hell.
Big back.
He is big.
Well, so that's 16 and a half stone. And when Patrick Tobacco came on, Bill McLaren said he's a big, strong boy. He's 6'6", which is big. But he then said he's approaching 16 stone for a lock forward, which is not big.
Ooh, watch out.
Closing thoughts on this?
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tim Sims is a lot bigger than I thought.
It's a great closing thought.
A lot bigger. Closing thoughts are, this Leicester team was amazing. My closing thoughts are this. The game is enjoyable because I think this Leicester team were probably one of the best club teams ever to grace rugby. It also makes the current situation that Leicester find themselves all the more unpalatable. You know, when you see what the institution has achieved, you know, the success that they've had, where all those players came from and the systems and the values that they grew up with compared to what's happening at that club now, it just puts it in so much more of a stark contrast. So that's my role to takeaway. Leicester, get your house in order.
Yeah, that was exactly, almost very, very similar. My main takeaway was, Leicester are a club that need a really horrible front five of local lads.
Yeah.
There you go. That'll solve everything for them.
Back to basics.
Yep.
Where are you going to find local lads the size of Lavanini?
Well, you can bring them in from Bristol like Genji.
Well, they've yeah. done it. Who's that prop? I can't remember I've forgotten the name of the prop. The young...
Bateman.
No, the young lad that's...
Oh, the new one.
Yeah. Well, him. There's a perfect example.
Him.
That guy.
They just need nasty... They need some... Wherever it comes from, it doesn't have to be local lads, but they need horrible, horrible players.
Well, you know, they had Ed Slater.
There you go. Local lad.
Captain.
Horrible player in all the best ways.
Good leader.
Why don't we round up with this? Leicester actually announced today that Borthwick is going to be head coach.
Yes. Yeah.
So that was hot off the press. Not that anyone didn't know this, but that means Jordan Murphy has been rewarded for all his success in coming up to Terrence of Rugby.
He kept them up last season.
Yeah, what a boss.
And on that bombshell.
Yeah, that's something for us to discuss on Sunday. We're at Rugby Podcast on Twitter. Game next week?
Nope, still all off, mate. COVID-19.
Very good.
Hey,
let's decide midweek.
Yeah, fine.
And
done.
We'll set some homework on Twitter.
Done. Thank you very much for listening. Hit subscribe, and we'll be back with another podcast soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.